At the age of 16, Felicity Holt was forced to give up her dreams of becoming a nurse to become a domestic servant. For her days working in the kitchens of outback Queensland, she was paid not a full wage, but essentially pocket money. The government held on to the rest of the money. It placed it in a trust, but she was never paid in full. Felicity is one of tens of thousands of Indigenous Australians who have been fighting to recoup their stolen wages. Felicity joins me now, along with historian and author Dr. Roz Kidd, who is a specialist in Aboriginal affairs in Queensland and has written extensively on stolen wages. Felicity, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Roz, welcome to you.
Thanks, Cameron.
Felicity, when you were 16, those early days when you were taken away from your parents in southeast Queensland, what do you remember of that time?
Oh, well, I could remember it quite clearly. Like, I was starting my nursing career at the Cherbourg Hospital for the year 1953, and it was the beginning of 1954 that they sent me to Dalby to work at the St. Joseph's Convent at Dalby. And then I had two other jobs after that. They took you from one job and sent you to another one, whether you liked it or not. You just had to go. Then from Dalby I went to Longreach, and from Longreach I came back to Warwick.
Mm-hmm.
And finished at Warwick in 1956. So I did three solid years of domestic work.
So you weren't working as a nurse at all in this time?
No. They took me away from the hospital and sent me to Dalby. That's the finish of my nursing career.
Who took you away?
The government officials in Cherbourg.
Hmm. So when you found yourself on the pastoral station, which was after the time in Dalby, what was it like there? What was your time like there?
Oh, it was okay until I had a bad experience one night. the boss that I worked for, his name was Bruce Emmett, and he had a sister called Lynette, and then she had died, but I didn't know about it. But she appeared one night in the room. I think I must have been sleeping in her bed and in her room. And she appeared to me one night standing at the door, and I started screaming, and they all came running to find out what I was screaming about. And then I didn't stay too long after that. I took off. I wasn't waiting for Lynette to come back and show herself again.
That was enough for you, hey?
That was enough for me, yeah. That put the scare tactics into me.
How was your time working before you left under those circumstances? What was your working life like there? What were you doing?
Oh, we had to get up at about 5 o'clock in the morning and milk the cow, and then separate the milk from the cream, and then end up making butter out of the cream, and then cooking breakfast and getting the kids off to school and doing all the housework. It was all systems go.
Mm-hmm.
Our hours were unlimited. We wouldn't finish until about 10 o'clock that night.
Okay, so it was a hard way to make a living. What sort of money were you earning?
Well, they only gave me £1 a week. I think it was £4 a week. £3 went back to the settlement, and they gave us £1 pocket money.
Hmm. So the rest you never saw?
We never seen the rest of it.
Hmm.
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah. So the money went back to the settlement. Who got the money there?
I don't know who looked after it there. There was an office on the settlement run by white officials. He had the superintendent and some other guys working under him. And the person who looked after the wages, he was the one that looked after our money.
So were you were under the impression that one day you'd get your hands on it, I imagine?
That's right, yes.
Hmm. But you haven't?
When I became a free person, I got my certificate of exemption from the settlement. Mr. Warner got that for me. The grazier that I worked for outside of Warwick got that for me, because he didn't like paying me £1 a week. He wanted to pay me the full award wage, because he felt guilty about giving me £1 a week. He knew I couldn't live off it. So so when I got my exemption, he started paying me the full amount.
What exactly is a certificate of exemption?
That was I wasn't under the Act anymore. I could do as I pleased. I was a free bird. I could come and go as I pleased. I could have left that place and went somewhere else to work, or I could have gone overseas if I wanted to. The government had no more say over me. See, I wasn't under the Act anymore.
When did this happen? When were you made free?
In 1956.
Hmm. Okay. Ros Kidell, how many people have a similar story to this one?
Well, in Queensland, there were probably half of the Aboriginal population at any one time was under the Act, as they say, which was they were taken under control by the government against their will, of course, and lost all rights to everything they did. They lost rights to where they would live, where they would work. They had to get permission even to marry. Often the children were taken away. Anybody that protested, they would send them to a settlement such as Palm Island. And so people had no freedom at all.
So these are these the so-called, or what were called protective laws that were passed by the states?
Yeah, so-called protection laws. I mean, the argument in the early days, which 1897 was the first law that came in, and the argument was that they knew many Aboriginal people were being abused and exploited by employers or just purely by townspeople in rural areas and cities, and so they said, well, we must take them under control to protect them. But, of course, protection worked, well, it didn't even work as a two-way street. It was mainly for the benefit of the government so that it could remove Aboriginal people to missions or settlements or send thousands of people out to compulsory work like Felicity and control them and have them out of the way as white expansion moved across Queensland. Mm. And, of course, the other states were very similar too.
But what sort of abuses are we talking about here?
Well, every sort. I mean, there are physical abuses. Many people right through the 20th century who were under these controls, and the controls continued until the late 60s. Many people were flogged with chains or were assaulted or were not given proper shelter, were not given safe water. There were many people who died of diseases which were preventable. I mean, all of this stuff is on the government's files. That's the only reason I know about it. It's still on the government files, and they knew these abuses continued, but they continued to run the system, and in part they ran the system to control the physical being of people, but also it became a huge lucrative benefit to the government's, to their consolidated revenue. They made a fortune out of their control of Aboriginal earnings.
And this is where the term stolen wages comes in. The argument
exactly,
is that this
yeah.
money belonged to these Aboriginal workers.
That's right. Well, I mean, it wasn't only wages. This is the thing. It was every aspect of people's right to have finances. For instance, when child endowment was introduced and it was applicable for Aboriginal mothers, that was 1941, the government immediately took most of that child endowment. It said it needed it to look after mothers, but in fact it pocketed the money. That's quite clear from their own records. Mm. When the aged, invalid and widow's pensions came in 1960, I've got a letter where the government said in the year before it, well, we've got to work out how we can divert these into consolidated revenue. And effectively, that's what they did. So hundreds of millions of dollars of pensions, child endowment went into the government's pockets. Many of the estates from deceased Aboriginal people were never handed through to families. The government put extra levies on people's wages in addition to people who were being taxed. And these levies went into trust funds, which was supposedly for the benefit of Aboriginal people, but again, they were used to cover government expenses.
But in someone like Ros's case... Felicity's case, my apologies.
That's okay.
It sounds like the farmer or the pastoralist still paid the full wage, did they?
In most cases, yes. I mean, we know even the pocket money component, which was generally up to about a quarter, we know from the audit reports that in many cases that wasn't paid at all. In fact, many local police who were protectors said, well, the pastoralists are just pocketing this money, and the government never bothered to check that. But the component that went to the government, it went actually initially to the local policeman and then to the government, or in Felicity's case, it went to the settlement chiefs, and that was supposed to be kept for that person to use when they needed it, and we know perfectly well that that often didn't happen. Mm.
On Bush Telegraph, we're talking about the so-called stolen wages, Aboriginal Australians who have never been fully paid for the work they did in the early part of their, predominantly the 20th century, often on pastoral country. With me is Ros Kidd, who's a historian and author, and also Felicity Holt, who has claimed stolen wages. Felicity, where exactly is your home country? Where would you describe your home country as?
Well, I'm originally from Warrabinda. I was born in Rockhampton only because my mother was only just a young teenager when she was having me, the first baby, so they had to take her to Rockhampton to have me. And then when I was born, she just came back to Warrabinda then and lived there.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up in Warrabinda and did all my education there.
Mm. So we're talking central Queensland and then moved south?
Yes, it's about 2 hours a drive southwest of Rockhampton, Warrabinda settlement.
What efforts have you made to recoup the wages that you have never seen?
Would you mind saying that again? I could hardly hear you because I'm a little bit on the deaf side.
What efforts have you made to recoup those wages that you never saw?
Well, we've taken that to the government, and this was in 2002. They gave us $4,000. And then we had to sign a piece of paper there in front of the government solicitor to say that we wouldn't take them to court for the rest of it. So that it was a sort of a blackmail letter. And anyways, but a couple of years later, they gave us another $3,000 after us signing that letter. And then after that, we didn't see any more money. That was it. That's the end of it.
So you signed the letter. It's like a compensation, I guess. You agree to take this money on the grounds that you won't take it any further.
We all had to sign it. They just stood over us and asked us to sign it to say we wouldn't take them to court for the rest of our money that they had.
Why did you sign it?
Well, if we hadn't signed it, we wouldn't have got the $4,000, and I think everyone was desperate for that $4,000. It was better than nothing. So we signed it, thinking that the $55 million would go around to everybody that had their wages stolen, but there's a hell of a lot of that money still left over, and it could be divided equally amongst the people that are alive today.
Do you regret signing it?
Now I am, yes. Yes. Looking back now, I regret signing it. A lot of people didn't sign it because they were hoping that they'd get about 30,000 or 40,000 or a little bit more. But they missed out, so they did that. There was a deadline for the $7,000, so they missed out altogether. So our $7,000 was better than not having anything at all. That's the way we looked at it.
Ros Kidd, there's been similar schemes, I understand, in other states as well, not just Queensland, a repayment, if you like?
Yes, there has been. I mean, there's a major problem with all of these repayment schemes, and that is that none of them make any sort of a public accounting for how many hundreds of millions of dollars have gone missing. And most of them, the people who, like Felicity, who accept the money, have no idea because they're never shown any record of their accounts. They have no idea how much they truly are owed. And this business of the government in Queensland sort of saying, well, we'll supply a solicitor and therefore you're giving legal consent, of course, is just rubbish because no solicitor in their right mind would advise somebody to take money if they had no idea how much they are legally owed.
So you said hundreds of millions of dollars missing.
Oh, absolutely. That's just Queensland.
How do you know that?
Well, you can work it out, as I have done, you can work it out starting at the beginning with the pocket money, the component of the pocket money, the wages over particular decades, and that scheme ran from 1900 to 1968, or thereabouts, and the amount of audit complaints that money was never paid. So if you say, well, let's say a third of it to a half of it was never paid, and you put that as your first sum, then you look at the equal numbers of complaints about the wages, which, of course, the wages that the government contracted with pastoralists were only a fraction of the white wage. They never paid the full wage. And you can calculate there and say, well, probably a third or a half of that went missing through police fraud, through forged signatures, through forged thumbprints. And these documents saying that this is the case. Mm. Then you get to the trust funds that the government set up. I mean, for instance, in the during the Depression years, the government moved millions and millions of dollars, the equivalent today, out of the private savings fund and out of trust accounts and never paid that back. So you soon, I mean, you're talking thousands of workers here, Cameron, and you're talking 60 years. And there's no way that a sum of $4,000 or $7,000 is anything like compensation.
So there's people like Felicity who signed up and took the $7,000, mm-hmm. even though she regrets it now. But has there been, or what court action has there been by others who didn't sign up to try to recoup a larger sum?
Well, we have tried to start a court action, and the Queensland Council of Unions were fantastic in backing that. And that, the first preliminary hearing was only a couple of weeks ago, and unfortunately it fell over at that first hurdle because the government claimed there were insufficient records for it to be able to adequately defend an action that it had lost this. It was a man called Conrad Yateman, that it had lost Mr. Yateman's money and that it couldn't account for it. So you have this perverse situation where the fact that they've lost the records, and I should add that Aboriginal people were never shown any record of what was happening. It all happened in secret. The fact that the government has lost the records is now the defence they're using to say, well, we couldn't possibly defend ourselves against an action.
But isn't there an argument that perhaps some of the money was used for things like food or board or other reasons?
Well, some of it was, yes. There's, some of it was, but an awful lot wasn't, and that's that component which the government has always known, which the auditors year after year after year said this money is being used improperly, we know these people are being defrauded. That's the component that I think should be fought over. Now, there was a very interesting parallel case in the US for Indian individual Indian accounts, that's what they were named. And they were controlled by the federal government over there, and they were taken to court, and they are now, the government is being forced into a multi-billion dollar settlement to pay people out. And the court said, if you cannot prove that you have paid that money properly, then we consider it not to be paid. And this would be the case, of course, for anybody suing their bank.
I know
the bank has that responsibility.
I know there's a petition that's has been put together earlier in the year in WA calling for a stolen wages scheme, a new Aboriginal stolen wages scheme there, basically claiming the previous one was inadequate.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is there any sign that WA will deal with this in a different way than Queensland?
I don't really know the WA case, except that they offered a maximum of $2,000, which was an absolute insult, and they said it was only to people who could prove that they lived on a government settlement. Now, WA had a scheme that was almost as comprehensive and almost as close to slavery as the Queensland scheme. So there were thousands of people there sent to work on pastoral stations who didn't ever go on a government settlement, so the government has neatly excluded all of those from any proper payment. I mean, the bottom line, Cameron, is a government brings in a law. It says it will do specific things to protect Aboriginal people. It says it will do specific regulations to protect their money, and then absolutely fails to do it. Mm. So we're not talking about whether or not it was appropriate at the time. We're talking about the laws and regulations they set up and the extent to which they failed, even by their own laws, and it's Aboriginal people and mothers, everybody, who've paid the price.
And when were these schemes most prominent in Queensland and WA, or were the, say, other states further south also, were these similar schemes also heavily used there?
Well, there was similar legislation, and actually there's a book which you can get free online, Hard Labour, Stolen Wages, which I put together to show right round Australia. But Western Australia and Queensland had the most comprehensive schemes. Northern Territory also sent thousands of people to work on pastoral stations. I don't think they were as thorough in their record keeping, which may allow them to get off the hook. Southern states such as South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales didn't have as large a component of full Aboriginal people, nor did they have as large an extent of pastoral employment. So far more of people in the southern states managed to get free of the Act at an earlier age.
So given the pastoral industry was one of the sources of employment here, mm-hmm. How important were Aboriginal workers to the expansion of Australia's pastoral industry?
They were absolutely crucial. I mean, even the protectors and the chief administrators at the time are saying, well, the pastoral industry wouldn't survive. And here in Queensland, not only were people being paid about a third of the white wage, and time after time, they've got letters saying, well, they're actually more useful than the white workers. They'll work harder and they're better at doing, you know, rural tracking of cattle and et cetera, you know. But not only were they doing that, but every time there was a bit of a slump in the cattle industry, they just cut the Aboriginal wages down as well. So there would not have been development without this cheap or almost free labour, that's for sure.
Felicity, how many people were with you working on the station, other Aboriginal people?
Oh, there was just myself and at Noonbar outside of Longreach and just myself outside of Warwick on North Toowoomba Station.
This is doing domestic duties.
When I was working at the convent, there was two of us. Mm-hmm. One girl worked in the laundry and I worked in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. But what about the stockmen at the time? Were they predominantly white stockmen or were there Aboriginal stockmen where you were working as well?
There was no Aboriginal stockmen there. There was just a rouseabout, a cowboy they call them, eh? Cowboys, rouseabouts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a white boy from Chinchilla.
Okay. Ros, I imagine there'd be stations across other parts of the country where there would have been a substantial number of Aboriginal stockmen.
Oh, yeah. In the more remote areas, they actually couldn't get white workers to go out there. And if the conditions were bad, the white men would just walk off their job, which, of course, is everybody's right, except if you were an Aboriginal person under the Act. And if you walked off, the police were sent after you and you were brought back in chains. And if you didn't behave yourself and stay there and put up with the conditions, they would send you away to somewhere like Palm Island for 3 or 5 years. I mean, people were split from their country and they were split from families and communities just at the whim of a government official. So it's certainly in the remoter areas, they were totally dependent on Aboriginal workers.
So this was a so-called protective law, but who was actually the government's representative then, looking after the so-called protected Aboriginal people?
Well, here in Queensland, they had what they called a chief protector. And then after 1935, I think it was, he was named Native Affairs, Director of Native Affairs. But here in Queensland, there were three men between 1914 and 1986, would you believe, that ran the department. And they were really Napoleons. They had total control. I mean, everything came to do with Aboriginal people. So you had housing, you had justice, if we could call it that. You had nutrition, you had hospitals, you had schools, you had employment, banking, absolutely everything. It was a closed field and very few other aspects of the government and departments had any say at all in what was happening with Aboriginal people. And it suited the government to keep it that way.
Felicity, how well do you feel the stolen wages case is known around Australia?
Oh, well, I only just know about the ones in Queensland. See, where all us girls that went out to work on these properties, we call them the slave labour days. We were just like slaves. Our hours were unlimited. It wasn't a 40-hour week them days. It was more like 100 hours a week. With us working there, we'd go from dawn until dusk, non-stop. But I don't know too much about the other states. I don't just know what went on in Queensland.
Cameron, we did have a Senate inquiry into stolen wages nationally, and if people want to Google that, you can find all of the submissions and all of the conclusions of that inquiry. That was 2007. That is online.
Okay, so if people are interested in finding out more, there's one option, the Senate inquiry into stolen wages. We'll also have a feature up on the front page of the ABC RN website later this afternoon, very soon. In fact, Ros Kidd, historian and author, thank you for joining us today. And Felicity Holt, who has claimed stolen wages, thank you for sharing your story as well.